from our CattleCast studios in Lansing, Michigan. Capital Area District Libraries is celebrating its 20th year, so visit our website, social media sites, and locations for special content and activities that celebrate this important milestone. We're also providing CattleCast listeners with a chance to win tickets to see The Lion King, a Kindle Fire, and other great prizes. Just listen for our special keyword and email it along with your contact information to connect@cattle.org. Ruby Lindsay, you've won a pair of tickets to see The Lion King at the Wharton Center. Stay tuned for this month's keyword, as well as our interview with Lansing State Journal columnist Graham Couch when CattleCast returns.
It's an exciting time for Capital Area District Libraries. They are celebrating 20 years of service in Ingham County. I'm here with Executive Director Scott Dimstra talking about how things have changed in that time.
That's right, Stephanie. Libraries have really come a long way from the very basic services people might remember from childhood. For one thing, libraries aren't just for borrowing things. You can also come to live programs and events. Over the last 20 years, we've hosted stars from HGTV, experts like Susie Orman, and authors like Sandra Brown.
That's an impressive lineup. So, Scott, what other activities can people find at Capital Area District Libraries?
We also offer all kinds of free family entertainment, everything from magic shows to concerts to live animals. There are shows that would normally cost a lot if you had to buy tickets for the whole family.
So do you have some events coming up this spring?
We have hundreds of them. Storybook character visits, Minecraft games, genealogy workshops. Get a complete list at our website, cadl.org.
All right, sounds good. That website again, cadl.org.
I am pleased to share with you another interview that is part of our 20 for our 20th series. My next guest has been the Lansing State Journal sports columnist since 2012. Graham Couch joins us on CattleCast. Hello, Graham.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
I grew up here, so this is a homecoming for me of sorts the last 5 years. Kind of a bucket list job. Went to, you know, at Lansing Schools, Verlinden Elementary, Otto, Sexton High School, grew up at St. Paul's Episcopal Church downtown, and grew up reading the paper that I now work for. So this was sort of always I was away for about 13 years, but a dream job of sorts.
Was this always your goal to come back to this area?
I'm one of those people who's always been happy everywhere I've been. So, I was in Kalamazoo for 6.5 years and at one point thought I could live here for forever. So I don't know that it was a goal per se, but when this job came open as it was something I definitely was interested in. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's been a lot of news about Michigan State University this last while, and you've written a number of columns related to the Larry Nassar scandal. In your column titled "For Lansing Area, the Larry Nassar Scandal is Personal," you wrote that, quote, "We're all hoping that we'll discover it's a boil, not a cancer, something that can be taken out easily." At this point, which do you feel it is?
It's really hard to say. I mean, it's been such a fast-moving story. And, you know, so many people already, the fact that Mark Hollis isn't there anymore. I mean, you could kind of see the writing on the wall with Louanna K. Simon. You could see where that was going, just the way I thought she was handling the victim statements. There was really no way to save it after that, her administration, I thought. But when you have John Engler in there now and you have an AD who's temporary, I mean, you got a lot of new leadership, and I don't know what they're thinking. And so, but I think, hopefully, and this is what MSU has to hope, and this is what the community has to hope, that when these investigations are complete, that they are transparent, thorough, and they root out issues, and people feel like the place is, I mean, there's always going to be a scar, but I think cleansed a little bit of this cultural issue and feels like it's a new beginning. But it's hard to tell exactly how deep. I think there are a lot of really good people at MSU. And so, say it's like a widespread cancer, you really hope it's not something that shows there were 7 or 8 places of not just negligence but cover-up or anything. You hope that nothing like that actually comes to be, but I think the truth and the answers is what's most important.
Mm-hmm. And time really is going to be the ultimate judge of all of this, how it plays out over the course of not even just the next several months, but years and perhaps even decades down the road.
Absolutely. And it comes at a time that the Me Too movement's happening. It's a very important cultural change, I think, and this is sort of the first I mean, there have been other things, but academic, big university scandal that comes along at this time in that movement. And so how we react culturally to, you know, women coming forward and people saying they were abused or they were harassed, and that's all changing. And so I think some of that probably would have taken place naturally over there, because I think everywhere you're going to start seeing that. You don't see people tolerate it.
Well, as a journalist, what's your reaction to how, like, ESPN is placing Coach Izzo and D'Antonio in the center of this scandal?
Well, I have some issues with the ESPN report. I've gone back and forth on how to sort of go at this, because it's not an airtight story. I think there was some really irresponsible stuff that was done, especially on the television side. When you have a big graphic in your background that has Larry Nassar, Mark D'Antonio, and Tom Izzo, that is conflating stories that have ties but are not tied together in that way. And you don't have enough sourcing, really, even. I mean, yes, there are questions that I think both of those men have to answer and those programs have to answer, but you don't have enough sourcing to really tie those two to any wrongdoing or handling, mishandling. The other problem is, even at the worst, if you think the worst of them, they're being questioned about mishandling something, not the actual deed itself, which Larry Nassar did, and maybe the largest sex abuse scandal in this country's history. So that bothered me. I think, you know, you can argue that the cultural issues over there make these stories sort of one. But the instances that were brought up and the sourcing in it, when you have people who are putting D'Antonio and Izzo based on hearsay when they hadn't met them or directly spoken to them, or we don't even know of their source. It's a kind of secondhand hearsay. I had some real issues. It would not have run in the Lansing State Journal, put it that way. It would not have run in most publications. And that's what I found most troubling, is a good editor would have taken a lot of that out and would have changed the tone of some of it too.
Well, now let's shift our conversation to what's happening on the court. Their youth is the reason that most are giving the Spartans for inconsistent play. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, some of it. There are young teams occasionally that are great and have it all, and Michigan State certainly is gifted enough to do it. But there is something I believe very much in, sweat equity, and just the idea that over time, as you invested more in a program, you care more and you do the little things right every day to win, and that's what ultimately separates you. Purdue has a lot of sweat equity. They have veteran players. Some of Villanova has a lot of sweat equity in that program and leaders. And so Michigan State has some of that, but not at its key positions. They have a lot of sophomores, and so how invested are they? And they also, they could really use, I've thought, the one thing this team lacks is sort of some nastiness on the court. And doesn't mean you have to be a bad person. Like Mo Wagner at Michigan, I think, is a really good kid, but he's a competitor on the court that gets after you a little bit. And that's a trait that can really help a team. And I don't know that this team's personality has that. So I think that probably in the sweat equity, the youth absolutely is part of it. People expect it so much because Bridges came back and there is a lot of talent, but you can't speed up certain processes.
So far in the season, how does this year's team compare with other Spartan teams?
Well, it's Tom Izzo's most gifted team, I would say. Whether it's his best team, I mean, there's a lot more that has to be proven. They don't defend as well as, say, the 2013-14 team, when you had Gary Harris as a sophomore, Keith Appling without the wrist, before his wrist injury and the loss of confidence. The way those two could defend on the perimeter with Denzel Valentine on the wing, Brandon Dawson and Adrian Payne, I thought that was his most matchup-proof team. I don't think this is that, because I don't think they have the guards who get after you defensively in quite the same way. So it's different, but they've never had rim protection like this, like with Jaren Jackson Jr., and that makes them different, and it gives them a shot if he can stay out of foul trouble. And to have a mix of him and Nick Ward, who is really just in the low post, just a beast that you usually don't get, right? I mean, that is a heck of a skill he has, the ability to finish around the rim the way he does. So to have that combination is something that nobody else has in college basketball, and Michigan State has never had before.
Will this Spartan team be in the Final Four?
If I had to guess, I would say no, but I think it'll be close. And you know, it's one of those things where I think they'll go away. I don't think they'll be upset early. I think they've got enough talent, you know, different than, you know, even if they ran into Middle Tennessee like that team did 2 years ago. They've got more different types of talent than that team. I think they would beat that team even on the wrong day that Middle Tennessee had, that great shooting day that day. The question for this team now, and this could change. My opinion on this very much could change. And they are showing some traits of toughness late in games, and especially on the road. But are they always focused early? Does Cassius Winston give them good quality? Because Winston changes everything. And, you know, against Iowa, they benched him for 9 minutes in the second half. When you're in early February and the guy who determines winning and losing more than anybody on your team is benched for 9 minutes in the second half, and that's where you are, you know, it's hard to say you're a Final Four team. That said, when I look around the country, I don't see many teams with a higher ceiling than them. I don't, you know, Virginia's really good this year, Purdue, you know, Ohio State, obviously very impressive of late, Duke, Villanova, but it's a handful. But I would put them in the top eight. Getting into the Final Four, I've got to see a little more.
Well, in addition to your columns in Lansing State Journal, you can watch Graham on Press Pass, which airs on Fox 47. Graham Couch, thanks for joining us on Cattlecast.
Thanks for having me.
Imagine if you could borrow a telescope, GoPro, or sewing machine from the library. Well, now you can. Introducing Library of Things from Capital Area District Libraries. Borrow items that range from playful to practical. Just visit cadl.org/things or stop by any Cattle branch to get started. Also, check out a Michigan Activity Pass for money-saving offers for museums, campgrounds, state parks, and more. Some restrictions may apply. Capital Area District Libraries. Everything right here.
From their humble beginnings in Cuba, Emilio and Gloria Estefan came to America and broke through all barriers to become a crossover sensation at the very top of the pop music world. On Your Feet takes you behind the music and inside the real story. Joining me now on Cattlecast are Christine Prades and Mauricio Martinez, who play the record-making couple in the hit musical. Welcome to Cattlecast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So first, please tell us a little bit about yourselves.
Well, I am actually originally from Miami, Florida. I'm Cuban-American, both my parents Cuban immigrants. I grew up there and was always singing and dancing and auditioning and recording music. And then I moved to New York about 4 years ago with a dollar and a dream kind of mindset. And actually was lucky enough to be a part and book On Your Feet on Broadway. Was there for about a year. Was the first cover of Gloria, and then I was also a swing, so I covered about 7 other tracks on the show. And then I was asked by Gloria herself to lead the tour, so here I am, about 4 months in.
Now, did I hear that you went to the same college as Emilio?
Yes, I did, actually. Okay. Miami-Dade College. I went to the Honors College there, and I remember actually seeing his face on one of the school buses.
Oh, wow.
That's actually, you know, they'll put, like, any successful individual who's been at the school, and I remember seeing that, and he was an MDC graduate, so I was just like, I don't know why I remember that, and then once I joined the show, I was like, I remember seeing that, so he actually graduated from here, so that's pretty awesome.
Wow. And Mauricio, what about you?
I'm from Mexico, originally from Mexico, from Monterrey, Mexico. Being imported to the U.S. like tequila and jalapeño and guacamole.
Delicious things.
And this is my first, well, actually it's my second. My American theater debut, playing Che in Evita a year and a half ago. And that's what started everything. Casting director discovered me there and emailed my Mexican management and asked if I were interested to audition to play Emilio Estefan. I didn't even know there was a show about the Estefans. I was in Mexico doing my thing, doing my albums and telenovelas and film and TV, lots of musicals. And yeah, I basically had my career there. I did study in New York 20 years ago. I'm a proud AMDA alumni, which is the American Musical and Dramatic Academy in Manhattan. I lived there for 3 years. And just life took me back to Mexico, but New York and I had a love affair, and we had something pending, and it was this beautiful gift that was my Broadway debut that I did last summer, starring as Emilio Estefan on Broadway.
Yeah.
And then after that, they offered me the tour.
Now, growing up, were either of you fans of, like, even Miami Sound Machine?
My goodness, I grew up, and I remember my mom taking out the Blue Gloria's Greatest Hits CD.
Yes.
And she would play it almost every single, I can't remember a day that I wasn't at least hearing one of those songs, and I would listen to her all the time, and we looked up to her, and my mom was always like, you know, if you want to look up to anyone, this is a woman who is representing us and representing our Cuban culture and representing the possibility of doing whatever it is that you want to do, and she's broken all the barriers. So she was definitely an inspiration for me and for my whole family growing up. And I mean, we're from Miami, she's from Miami, so it was definitely the anthem of our city as well. She was taking our city and our culture all over the world. So we definitely, I definitely looked up to her ever since I was a young girl.
And I remember growing up, I'm a child of the 80s, so MTV was like everything. Right. And I grew up with both cultures. Being from Monterrey, Mexico, it's a very Americanized city. So I grew up with both MTV and all the American musicals and movies, and also the Spanish soap opera, telenovelas, and mariachi, and like Mexican pop, you know? So there was this woman that I would see on television that my mom had her albums in Spanish, and all of a sudden I would see her also in MTV or VH1 singing the exact same song in English. And I used to sing Don't Want to Lose You Now, which is my favorite Gloria Estefan song of all time, that now I get to sing on stage. I knew it in Spanish because of my mom, but then I would see her on television in English. And I didn't get it at first. I was like, wow, somebody lives like me, because I grew up with both languages. And being that young, I never really got it until later. After that, of course, John Secada and Ricky Martin and Shakira, Thalia, every single one of them, those artists, then I found out that they were influenced and supported by the Estefan. So, yes, I grew up being a fan, not only of Gloria and the Miami Sound Machine, but what they did to the music, to the Latin music, crossing over. You know, it's very inspiring to as a Latino.
Mm-hmm. Christy, can you describe the first time that you met Gloria?
Oh my gosh. The first time I met her was actually in my final audition. So I actually walked in. There were a couple of callbacks, and I actually auditioned to be part of the ensemble, which is one of the dancers. And then once they heard me sing, Jerry Mitchell gave me the pack, and he was like, you need to come in and sing for the whole team. So I walked into that audition room, and I saw her and Emilio sitting there along with Jerry Mitchell, which is a Broadway legend as far as direction. You know, Sergio Trujillo, Broadway legend as far as choreography. Mm-hmm. And we had all of our producers and our stage managers, but I walked in and I saw them. And I remember just shaking their hands and just being like, I need to remember I have so much to offer, because seeing them, I just questioned everything about me for a second, because you're taken aback a little bit. And I was in a way shocked to finally meet this woman right in front of me that I've looked up to, and Emilio as well, because I always saw him everywhere. Right. So I bowed down to both of them in the beginning, which made everybody laugh. I was like, okay, good, I'm funny. And then I just started singing, and I was totally myself, but I felt connected, and it was a beautiful experience to meet them there.
Oh, I bet. Well, and then I heard you tell the story of when you were selected. Was that live right on stage
when
that happened?
Yes, that was post-performance. So we had finished a whole medley of the show, and they walked on, and we had all the news stations there, which, again, I thought was, you know, to promote the tour. They're going to announce it officially in Miami in the Arch Center, our home theater. And, my family was there. Everybody was there. And then she just announces it, and I'm just like, there was more to this, and I had no idea, and how dare you put me on this spot. But it was, it was wonderful and so unexpected and classic. Wow. Classic for me. I'll always remember it, and I have it recorded, and I'll never forget that feeling.
Great memories, for sure.
Yes.
Well, Mauricio, while millions know and love Gloria's voice and music, share with our audience how important Emilio was in her success.
Well, he's very important, because not only was he the leader of the group, the Miami Latin Boys, which was the first group that he actually had to change the name, because he was just blown away by Gloria's talent, that he then had to rename it Miami Sound Machine, and Gloria became the front singer. And he became the manager, and then he became her manager, and then they fell in love, and then they got married, and then they had a kid, and then they conquered the music world. So I cannot think of one without the other.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
To this day, you see them and you think immediately, I mean, she has his last name. They're one. I see them as one. that's how important Emilio is to Gloria and Gloria to Emilio.
Yeah, there's no Gloria without Emilio. There's no Emilio without Gloria.
And you see that to this day, their dynamic, how they live their lives, how they go to events together, how they come here and take care of the show. How
they do business.
Yeah, everything. They're really, really, really together and in love. And that's how I see. And he's definitely very, very important in the story of her life. She's said it publicly. If it weren't for him, she wouldn't have made everything that she did. You know, she wouldn't be probably as big because he was the business man. He
pushed
her
to her limits.
Yeah.
He pushed her to break the barriers of like her own, because she didn't want to. Because she didn't want to be all that.
Right.
She wasn't ready to be all that. She was very shy. She kept her music very private. And he was the one who constantly pushed her beyond her limits, beyond what she thought that she could do until the very end, even until the end. It was he was the confidence within her.
Gave her
that he
strength.
Was like, you can do this. You can do this. And he pushed her into... That's how I feel like I'm doing the show. I'm always uncomfortable. Yeah. She's always uncomfortable. And he's literally there
and
to
he's always
like,
driving.
Yeah, and he's like, you're good.
You're good. You're good.
You can do this.
You can do this. There's a beautiful scene in the first act where it just defines the relationship and defines the personalities, where Gloria's sitting down, very shy, as a young girl, playing the piano, singing Anything for You. And there's a room, which is the Emilio's garage, where they're all kids still playing. You know, they're not even famous. They don't even have a recording contract. And the abuela's there.
They don't know
the
what
mother.
They're doing.
And
right?
She starts playing, and he stands up. And the rest of the cast, which the people in that room, disappear. And you're left alone, Emilio standing, just watching this beautiful girl, talented girl, sing. And his mind, he literally goes around her. And it's almost as like he has this, he knows.
He's plotting.
That he has found a diamond. Hmm. A diamond in his life that matches his passion, you know?
Yeah.
So that's when you see the essence of Emilio and Gloria. That's, for me at least, that's when I see, you know, like he found his gem. Mm.
So you've kind of already done this, but how would you describe this musical? I mean, the laughter and love and all of that mixed in, but there's a lot to this.
Yes, it's very high energy. I mean, we have not heard one person who's seen the show who's not like, it is a lot that you guys do on stage, and I don't know where we find it within us, but it's definitely high energy. But it's also, I think people don't, it's a beautiful surprise because they don't realize that there's a real story within this. There's real conflict, real human conflict. You know, other musicals, you know, it's all fantasy and it's all a made-up story, but this is conflict within family, conflict within business, conflict within obstacles when you're trying to face your dreams, conflict within injury, within wondering if you're even going to make it out alive kind of thing. So people are definitely surprised when they see the roller coaster of emotion that comes with this story. And not only that, but I feel like this story also helps the audience realize, you know, there's a theater etiquette, right? So we come to a show and we're expecting, you know, everybody's polite and everybody waits until the song finishes to sing. You know, there's an etiquette that we feel. And what's funny with us is that we get to show them, you know, we break that fourth wall sometimes within this story. So we're literally pulling them out of that etiquette for a few moments, which is a really, really great, at least for me. I love this transition where I'm like, you can look at me. I'm looking right at you. And I know you're freaking out right now because, you know, it's supposed to be a theater where you guys aren't supposed to be there, but it kind of helps them, you know, we get them to be part of the story. You can stand up, you can hang out with us, you can feel the music, you can dance. Like, we're giving them permission to really be about communicating with us while we break that barrier. Mm-hmm. So I think that this show has a lot more to offer than just, you know, people thinking it's going to be like a jukebox musical.
Right.
It's definitely way, way more than that.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
Very neat. Well, for those who haven't purchased tickets yet, obviously it's not too late, but could you just give us just a little sample, just a few bars of what they might hear at the show?
Oh my goodness. I haven't even, me, like, warmed up.
Here we are that we did together.
So then we go, it's nothing.
There's nothing I can do. I'm helpless in your arms. Oh, baby, what you do? I'm in love and this is it. There's no turning back this time. No, no, no. Here we are, all alone. Trembling hearts, beating strong. Reaching out, breathless kiss. I never thought could feel like this.
Right, all right. All right. For in the morning, that's not bad.
That is just great.
Well, that was cute. That's the first time we've ever done that, you know, for a podcast. Yeah. Without, so that was really nice.
Very cool. Even a cappella without mics and without.
Boom. Okay.
Bold adventure there, right?
We're falling in love here.
Well, Christy and Mauricio, thank you so much. And the success of this Broadway musical, On Your Feet, it's at Wharton Center right now. Runs through February 18th. You can visit their website for ticket information. But thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you guys for having us. We appreciate it.
Bringing the Latin heat.
Let's go. Let's go. Make it happen.
To celebrate Capital Area District Library's 20th birthday, we're giving CattleCast listeners a chance to win great prizes, like a Kindle Fire or a pair of tickets to see The Lion King. Just listen for the special keyword during new episodes of CattleCast. When you hear it, email it to connect@cadl.org, along with your contact information. Winners will be announced during the following month's episode. Each month, a new keyword will be announced, so keep listening to the CattleCast podcast.
Technology has become a vital and integral part of Capital Area District Libraries, and for the last 16 years, the responsibility of my next guest, Cheryl Knox, Cattle's Technology Director, joins me now on CattleCast. Hello, Cheryl.
Hey. Hi, Mark.
So explain to us your role as Technology Director.
Well, I have a small staff of people, and the shorthand way of describing what we do is we take care of everything that plugs in, from the network to internet access, computers, printers, all the peripherals. We take care of it all. We have over 500 computers, end-user computers that we take care of, and a network that spans the entire county. So it's a big job, but it's also very exciting.
That's great. And for such a small team of people, such a key role in the library world too, right? So Cattle's moving to a new service called Patron Point. What is it and how will it benefit our patrons?
Patrons of Cattle know we send you lots of email and notices about your account, but we also like to engage you and entice you to come to our events and programs. Patron Point is a tool that we'll be using to help get to know exactly what it is, what you like, so that we can send you communications that key in better to exactly what you want and what you like. We don't want to spam you or send you things you're not interested in. We want to engage you and entice you to come to the library and use the library the way you want to use it. So Patron Point's going to help us do that.
So tell us about some of the planned updates to our patron computers. We have so many people in every day using them for, could be email, Facebook, any number of things, but what are some of the planned changes?
We have a regular schedule that we go through to update all of our computer hardware and make sure that it doesn't get too old and too rickety. So this is our year to replace our patron computer environment. We're going to be sitting down with all of our head librarians and thinking through exactly the best way to spend the money on those computers. Maybe we don't need as many computers, but we need to be able to do more and different things on certain computers. But at a bare minimum, our computers get a lot of use, and they start to break down, and it's time to replace many of them. So coming into the library later this year, you'll enjoy brand new computers that boot faster and are just far more capable.
Will there be any changes to the Cattle website or the Cattle, very popular Cattle app?
We're consistently and continually trying to improve both of those products. We've already hard at work on a redesign of our website. The current site has been in service for a little over 5 years, and it's time to give it a new look and improve some of the ways that it helps you get to what you need. Be looking for that around the middle of the year. So we're shooting for June for a nice birthday present for cattle, for that to look nice and new and fresh and be easier to navigate. The app is also a fun project. We get lots of great feedback. People really enjoy using that to keep, especially to keep tabs on their accounts and renew and do holds and be able to use it as their library card, not having to fumble around in their pocket to find a physical card, etc. Right now, I am working with our app developer to get a roadmap of new features to and improvements to make in the app in the first quarter of this year. One of the things is we're going to improve it to be able to hold multiple accounts. For example, a parent could also put in the cards of their kids and be able to track what they've got checked out and what the, you know, the parent has on their own account. It'd just be easier to keep tabs on several library accounts so the whole family can come and enjoy the library.
And there's a lot of things you can do with it now that people may not even be aware of. Give us some of the things. You mentioned having the library card right on the app, so you don't even need to carry the physical card anymore. But what are some of the other cool features?
Kind
of
hidden gems in the app.
Yeah.
I would say one of my favorite parts is the staff picks. If you go into the Find Books and More section of the app, there is a section towards the bottom called Staff Picks. And it's just really fun to see the wide variety of materials that our staff have read or watched or listened to and enjoyed and want to share with other people. I find a lot of really interesting reads that way. And then down there in that same menu right next to that is an ISBN search feature. And you can actually use that on your phone. Let's say you're in the bookstore or your friend has a book and she's recommending it to you. You can use the camera on your phone to scan the ISBN and see if we have it in our catalog and put a hold on it right then. So that's a fun one.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for sharing some of the updates and things to come this year with us, and we'll look forward to those improvements and changes over the coming year. Now, if you would you please provide us with this month's cattle keyword?
Well, I've been told that the keyword is app.
All right, this month's cattle keyword is app. That's APP. So email it now along with your name and phone number to connect@cadl.org. That's connect@cadl.org. And you could win great prizes like a family four-pack of movie passes. Cheryl, thanks for appearing on CattleCast, and we look forward to all the changes that you mentioned. Stay tuned for more right here on CattleCast right after this. Recently, Michigan State University hosted an appearance by Dr. Michael Eric Dyson as part of their Dr. William G. Anderson lecture series, Slavery to Freedom. Jessica Trotter got a chance to interview Dr. Dyson as part of our 20 for our 20th series.
All right, thanks, Mark. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson is a Georgetown University sociology professor, a New York Times contributing opinion writer, and contributing editor to the New Republic and Espen's undefeated website. His latest titles include Tears We Cannot Stop, A Sermon to White America, and The Black Presidency, Barack Obama and the Politics of Race in America. Dr. Dyson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk
Thanks
to us.
For having me.
Tears We Cannot Stop, your latest book, is written from a different approach than many of your other works.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about how it came to be?
Yes, well, there's no question that this is a more personal book. I wanted to have a different tone. I wanted to be intellectually rigorous, but I also wanted to be existentially vulnerable, to tell the truth about my journey, my suffering, my pain, my heartache, and my, if you will, vision for what America could become. But in order to do that, I had to tell the truth about what was going on, about my sons, about police brutality, about my experiences with that. Growing up in Detroit, the experiences of racism that I had confronted. So I wanted to tell the truth about all that stuff, and that meant that I had to step outside of a merely academic framework to really try to be more vulnerable myself and tell the truth so that people could identify with me as an agent of my destiny, but also as a person who, like them, was struggling with bigger problems that needed to be addressed.
It was something that even I had to kind of put down every once in a while and just sort of breathe and take in and let the frustration out.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah, that's what I wanted to tell the truth. And sometimes it gets kind of brutal and kind of raw.
And then also, I noticed on Twitter that at the end of December, you were putting the final touches on a new book.
Yes, What Truth Sounds Like, Robert F. Kennedy, James Baldwin, and our unfinished conversation on race. So another book that tries to really talk about a very famous meeting between Robert Kennedy and James Baldwin and Lorraine Hansberry and Harry Belafonte and Lena Horne. And, you know, the kind of ideas they grappled with, the way in which they were wrestling with the future of race, street-level racial politics versus the kind of neoliberal liberal consensus about what was happening. And the clash between Robert Kennedy and the black people was instructive, and it remains instructive to this day. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to look at that meeting that was held some 55 years ago to see if we couldn't extract some understanding of why it continues to resonate for us today.
I think for our listeners, I think that might have a June release date.
Yes,
but that will be
June
holdable at the library not too long from now. What writers are interesting to you right now, or what's catching your eye? Or
Yeah, Chimamanda is very interesting to me. Teju Cole, you know, so I'm enjoying some of that stuff. You know, whether it's a book on Aaron Burr, by the fine scholar who wrote the book on whiteness, Professor Nancy. You know, Gabrielle Union's book, you know, telling the truth about her own experience as a black woman and a survivor. That's right. You know, so those are the kind of things that have been interesting to me,
that's
you know,
great.
Recently.
What's your feelings on Black Panther?
Oh, man, I can't wait to see it. I can't wait to see it. You know, I heard somebody say today they want to let it get $500 million. I was like, wow, that would be amazing. In the first weekend, I said, oh, my God, I don't know, but maybe. I mean, the reviews have been incredible.
Yes.
The ideal is remarkable.
Yes.
How appropriate in this time. Not maybe thought of during Obama's time, but coming to fruition under Trump is especially delicious and especially worthy of our support, because it is a one man, one character, one film antithesis to all of the vitriol and the hatred that has been generated under this presidency. So I am so excited to see it. I mean, films and books probably bear a burden that's bigger than the writing or the making of them, and understandably so, because they are freighted with our desires and our wishes. And I think Black Panther bears what Baldwin called the burden of representation.
Right.
And but I can't wait to see it. I'm so excited.
I'm right there with you. Thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, I got to tell you, I love librarians, I owe some fines now. I hope you can absolve me. You know,
because I'm working on my own.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I used to skip school in Detroit and go to the public library. That's what I did. On, you know, downtown, because I knew I was not getting a good education, but I knew there the hallmark of reason was contained in those books. And I'm especially gratified to talk to you as a librarian, and I love librarians.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
Kathy Lancaster is the Youth Services Librarian at the Library of Michigan, and she's here today to talk about some special events for young children and families. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about your job as the Youth Services Coordinator for the Library of Michigan.
Just talking to Trent earlier about that, and we did not have a Youth Services Coordinator for almost a decade at the Library of Michigan due to funding, and once that funding became available, they were able to open that position back up again, starting with statewide library services. And statewide library services go out to libraries across the state of Michigan and engage them, talk to them, get to know what they need from the Library of Michigan. And then I'm able to go out and offer workshops and trainings, webinars, and get them the information and the continuing education that they need for youth services across the state.
And that would include things like the summer reading program?
Correct. So the Collaborative Summer Library Program is a nationwide program. I'm the state rep for that, so I get to go to the annual meetings, learn what's coming. We vote on topics such as themes and slogans, and I get a lot of feedback from libraries across Michigan to help me make those decisions on how we're going to vote. So, for example, we are going to be voting this April on summer themes for 2022. if you can really go that far out with planning.
Well in advance, yeah.
Yes, yep.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your relationship with the Early Childhood Literacy Coalition.
Sure.
And I know you and Cattle as well are members of this group. First, tell us, what is Early Childhood Literacy Coalition?
Sure thing. I've been a member for a couple of years now, but it began in May of 2000 when a few organizations in the Ingham County area said, hey, you know, we're really reaching out to the same populations. We're looking at early childhood, we're looking at literacy, and why don't we work together and make more things happen?
Right. Well, our former downtown Lansing library head, Kathy Johnson, was a part of that initial group to help get the organization going.
Yes, it's been great. WKAR is a member. You have public libraries from various tri-county area libraries, I should say. And then we also have Ingham Great Start, the ISDs, we have Reading is Fundamental. All those organizations come to the table and plan events for March's Reading Month.
Which is perfect because they really, all of these agencies really do work and try to promote reading and literacy with a similar audience in mind.
Exactly. And coming together, they found with these partnerships that not only are they focusing on the month of March and able to do some big events for that, but they're having lots of little side projects come out of these meetings that happen monthly here in the county.
Well, let's talk about the big event coming up. It's Sunday, March 18th. It's the Literacy Celebration stage show and an afternoon of activities. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's great fun. If anyone listening has ever been, we have different performers every year. This year, we're having Karen Bonanici. She's a storyteller, and she's going to be coming with music and stories, and she's just a lot of great fun, and she's performing twice that afternoon. And then we're also going to have the opportunity to have our Ready to Read Michigan book author and illustrator. So the Library of Michigan puts out a program every year now, Ready to Read Michigan, which focuses on early literacy. And the book this year is I Got the Rhythm, and author Connie Schofield Morrison and illustrator Frank Morrison will be coming to present their story, talk to the kids about writing, and Frank will be illustrating live, and they'll have some interaction with I Got the Rhythm.
And some storybook characters as well,
yes,
right?
So now that's, I think, the real fun. All the characters that come and kids can engage and hug them. They're shy, you know, they can sit near them or they can just, you know, get, it's a great picture opportunity. And we also have some other live music happening throughout the day. All the agencies that are part of the coalition have tables and they have hands-on activities and they have movement and lots of fun things for the kids to do.
Can you give us a little hint at which characters will be there?
There's this cat and he's got buttons. Do you have any guesses?
Could that be Pete the Cat by
it's
any chance?
Pete the Cat.
Pete the Cat, a very
cat
popular
is
character.
Be there. and kind of some classical characters are going to be there, like Peter Rabbit and Clifford. Yeah. So lots of great fun with the characters.
Where does this take place and is there a charge for it?
It's free. It's going to be at the Hanna Community Center on Abbott Road in East Lansing. It's going to be from 1 to 3:30. Karen will be performing at 1:15 and 2:45, and the I Got the Rhythm author and illustrator will be on stage at 1:50. But like I said, the whole afternoon, lots of stuff going on. Come and stay. Come and hang out. There's also a free book while supplies last for each family.
So it's Sunday, March 18th, 1 to 3:30 p.m. at the Hanna Community Center. No registration or tickets or anything is necessary, right?
Nope, just come on in
just
and enjoy
in.
The fun. And we're really encouraging, especially families with children under 5.
There are 2 weeks of free activities for kids as well at different ECLC agencies and things like that with some of the character visits too, right?
Yes, the Early Childhood Literacy Coalition offers the characters throughout the counties here that participate. So starting March 9th at Eaton Rapids Public Library, Peter Rabbit will be there. And it goes through March 23rd. We've got various characters out throughout the month. And you can find the schedule on our Facebook page, facebook.com/Early Childhood Literacy. Literacy Coalition. You can also find the full schedule of events on the CADL
website.
Yes.
CADL.org.
Correct.
And the full schedule's there, as well as details about the Sunday, March 18th event at the Hannah Center.
You've got it, Mark.
Well, Kathy, thank you for joining us today. It looks like a fun time ahead for families and lots of fun. So thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
My family has been going to the library for many years. The kids used to love checking out books and going to story time. Now Capillary District Libraries is celebrating its 20th birthday. Executive Director Scott Dimstra, I'm sure a lot about the library has changed in that time.
That's right, Steve. We still have story times for little ones with many kinds to choose from, but we've also added a lot more resources for young children. Now we have early literacy iPads loaded with preschool learning games. We have backpacks stuffed with books and games that they can check out with themes like dinosaurs and trucks. We also have subscriptions to digital services like ABC Mouse and Tumble Books.
Kids will love that.
And since parents are so important in the process of helping kids learn to read, we also have lots of resources for them. For example, they can get tips on how to incorporate early literacy practices into everyday family life. It's all part of our free Raising Readers service.
Where can families find out more?
Just visit any CADL branch or our website, cadl.org.
We now return back to the campus of Michigan State University, where Sherry McConnell is with Dr. William G. Anderson.
Thanks, Mark. I'm speaking with Dr. William Anderson, Create the Slavery to Freedom Lecture Series, which is sponsored by the College of Osteopathic Medicine at Michigan State University. And it's really an honor to meet you, sir.
Thank you, Sherry. It's my honor to share with you.
You were the 2003 speaker.
Wow.
In this series.
That's a long time ago.
And your topic was Black History, Who Needs It? And during your talk, you mentioned Newt Gingrich, Dinesh D'Souza. They're still around.
Yes.
15 years later, who needs Black History Month now?
We all need it now even more than possibly 18 years ago when the series first started. We have seen racism disguised many different ways. And the fact that there has been a Black president did not erase it. The fact that Blacks now hold office in many states in the Union as governors, as lieutenant governors, and in other positions, it still has not erased. As a matter of fact, it is my opinion that the election of Obama deepen the conviction of some racisms that that is where they belonged, in the midst of racism. In other words, electing Obama did not eliminate racism. If anything, it emboldened it because they want to get at Black people and they would like to get at Obama, but they can't because he is relatively protected by his position as president. So what will they do? They will take it out on the Blacks that they are working with every day, that they see every day. This is their way of, we are getting even for this company, this nation, electing a Black president.
You did a 2011 oral history interview for the Library of Congress. Well, one of the things that you talked about was the difficulty of establishing your practice when you went back to Albany.
Yes.
And you talked about how amazed you were at the inadequacy of health care for Black patients at that time. What concerns do you have for health care for the Black community now and for Black patients?
Well, let me go back to when I entered practice in 1956, I believe, in Albany, Georgia, where racism was, that was the order of the day. In other words, there was complete segregation of the races, and that included patients who were sick and needed to be hospitalized. Black patients were put in the basement of the hospital when they were permitted to be admitted to the hospital, where they had to compete with the laundry facilities, steam pipes, sewage pipes, water systems. In other words, there was no such thing as a private room or semi-private room in the upper floors. So in my attempt, at least, to get them, keep them out of that environment, there was a hospital 50 miles away in Bainbridge, Georgia, a small hospital of 50 beds, that was owned by a black doctor. And I had the patients, if they were willing to travel 50 miles to be hospitalized so that I could do surgery on them or treat them medically, I would take them to Bainbridge. Needless to say, I had very, very few white patients while I was in practice. And the only ones I had were those who were familiar with osteopathic medicine, and they would come to me for osteopathic treatment. Mm-hmm. Other than that, I only had black patients. Now, I would write prescriptions for my patients, and I would always put a title, Mr. or Ms., or Mrs. or Miss, on the prescription. Mm-hmm. Several of my patients complained about the fact that when they would fill a prescription, Mr. or Ms. would be missing from the prescription. Yes, and one of my patients was persistent enough that she went back to the pharmacist and said, you did not fill this prescription the way my doctor wrote it. He had Mrs. Mary Jones, and I don't see Mrs. on that. So after I got a number of those complaints, I decided then, well, I had to have a drugstore that they would be given the kind of respect that I wanted my patients to get. So a few of us got together and opened a drugstore.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. And we hired a pharmacist who was black, and my patients would go there, and if I wrote Mrs. Mary Jones, the prescription was filled for Mrs. Mary Jones.
Wow. So besides starting a practice, you also started
a movement
with colleagues. Yeah. Well, absolutely.
I cannot take full credit for starting it. Actually, it was the students. The organization, I think, maybe still exists. It's called the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC. Mm-hmm. The students came into Albany with one avowed purpose, to get blacks to register to vote. Because up until that time, a black could not get registered to vote in Albany, Georgia. Now, not that they did not have the legal right to get registered to vote, but the registrar or the clerk always found a reason not to be available to register them, or they would have to answer questions that could not be answered by a Harvard PhD, like, we want you to read and interpret the Articles of Incorporation or the Articles of the Constitution of the United States. In other words, they were saying there's no way a black is going to get registered to vote in this town. So the students, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, came into Albany with that purpose, getting blacks to register to vote. And they were abused, they were intimidated, they were threatened, but they had, let me say, nothing to lose. They were students. Right. They owned no property. They were not looking for loans or mortgages. They didn't own automobiles. They came there with nothing but their bodies, and they presented their bodies as a testament to, this is what we want to accomplish, get blacks to register to vote. So they would walk by my office. My office was in Harlem, would you believe? Even Albany had a Harlem. And my office was in Harlem on the second floor of a building where there was a pool hall beneath my office and a liquor store beneath my office. But I was in the midst of where blacks would congregate frequently. So the students would bring those potential registrars by my office, and I saw that. And it pricked my conscience because I said, they are doing that for me and for my children. I could not, in good conscience, sit and watch them being treated the way they were treated, trying to get blacks to register to vote, and they were being rebuffed the way they were. So I went out and joined them.
I have one more question for you.
Sure.
The question I have for you is, can you share any words of encouragement for those people who are following, like your mother? They may have some roadblocks to getting that degree. They may have to, you know, take a semester off and yes, go back and work.
No one should be denied the opportunity to get an education. Sometimes you have to insist on it. Sometimes you have to make some sacrifices for it. Let me say this, not that I am political, I am somewhat political, but I'm of the opinion that no child should be denied an education. I'm talking about the very best education that they can get because they do not have the money. Education should be free. Now, that is not to say don't give back. No, no. When you get this education now, you owe it back to the community where you came from to serve there.
Thanks for listening to Cattlecast, and remember to email us this month's keyword, which is app, to connect@cattle.org. That's connect@cadl.org for a chance to win a great prize. We also invite you to listen to our Executive Edition and Reader's Roundtable podcasts, which are available through Google Play and Apple Podcasts. See you next month for more Cattlecast.